Janine Bender would not lower the shotgun until she was absolutely sure that the man in the car was really her son. Albert's latest acquaintances made her untrusting of all strange cars, especially those that appeared on her doorstep in the middle of the night. She moved across the porch to her right, avoided a pair of wicker chairs that she'd refinished last week, and poked the barrel of the shotgun across the hood of her pickup to the two men sitting in the front seat of an old station wagon. The porch light reflection bouncing off the car's windshield made it difficult to see. The passenger appeared motionless, head to window. Something stained his shirt, but she couldn't tell what it was. The driver was her son. She could see him clearly as he stood from the car. His thin brown hair cropped above the ears outlined the small face of a boy who had moved another 6 months toward manhood since she'd last seen him. His shirt was also stained in about the same location as the passenger's. She looked past him, following the gray outline of the front road beyond the barn, until she was satisfied that nothing else was out there. "Mom," Lenny repeated, "please, don't shoot." It was then that Janine realized she had the shotgun pointed at her son's head, and immediately lowered it. "What in Moses' name are you doing out here in the middle of the night, Lenny?" Janine gazed at the man in the car as Lenny emerged from the station wagon. "And who's that? You know me and strangers." "He's hurt real bad." Lenny walked around his mother's truck and ascended the 5 wooden steps to the porch. "He gave me a lift, but then we had a little..." "And you?" She grabbed his shoulder, lightly. Lenny flinched. "Are you hurt real bad?" She pulled him closer to her with one arm while setting the gun on the wicker table with the other. "Ow!" he yelped and pulled away like a little boy whose mother had just touched his little boo-boo. "Gunshot?" Janine said, surprised. "Who in Moses' name has been shooting you?" She turned him to look at the hole in his shirt where the bullet had exited. "Long story," Lenny said, exasperated. "The professor, he's worse off. Probably needs a doctor." Janine held her son gently by the sides of his head, looked into his brown eyes for answers that she was certain would not be revealed until much later, if at all. "Doctor," she said. "You know me and doctors." She didn't wait for an answer. She could see that Lenny was concerned. She didn't like strangers and she didn't like doctors, but she couldn't turn away an injured man, especially on the holy day. She'd have to repent for months. "Come on, let's get him inside." His mother was much grayer than when he'd seen her last. She looked as old as the professor, though Lenny was certain she was at least 10 years younger. Her eyes were grayer as well, having shifted from azure shortly after his father's death. It had been a strange transformation, blue eyes to gray. He never heard of a person's eyes changing color in the middle of adulthood. It had started with little gray flecks here and there. Now the pupils were completely gray. They walked together to the passenger side door of the station wagon. "He doesn't look well," his mother said. "Lost a lot of blood." Lenny opened the door slowly and the professor's body slid sideways. He was awake, but terribly weak. Lenny helped him into a sitting position. "We're going to move you inside," Lenny said. The professor responded, but Lenny could not understand. He slurred as if drunk. "We're going to need your help, okay?" Lenny reached under the professor's left thigh and arm and scooted him toward the edge of the seat. The professor helped, but not much. When Lenny looked around for his mother, he saw her standing motionless and staring into the cargo bay of the station wagon. "Mom, a little help, please?" She remained motionless. "Mom?" Lenny was about to lose his balance. His thin frame could not withstand the professor's weight much longer.
"Kaya, but..." the professor moaned.
"No touch." It took Lenny less than a second to understand what the professor was saying, since, simultaneous with this understanding, Lenny watched as his mother leaned into the glass-shattered rear window, her right arm stretched toward the cubit. It was the feeling associated with knowing something no one else knew. It was the feeling that she'd seen it somewhere before but was uncertain if it had been something real or something that had been part of a dream. It felt like desire and fear and helplessness wrapped together into one extremely unwanted emotion. She could not control herself. She had to touch it. Every fiber of her Christian being screamed for resistance, and this caused her arm and hand to shake as she reached into the station wagon. "No! Mom! No!" Its smooth wooden surface was a foot away.
She hesitated. "Don't touch it!" A little red star was buried in the wood at its top edge, centered, as if serving the function of a hasp, but it had no latch. It winked at her, or so she thought. She smiled, giggled. She hadn't giggled in years. The pads of her fingers wanted to gently caress it, its electricity. And in one quick motion, she was suddenly jerked forcefully backwards. "Mom!" Lenny screamed. She glared at the box, at Lenny, at the man who now lay on the gravel driveway after Lenny had let him fall. The man attempted to roll onto a knee, pushing himself upward with his good arm before falling back onto the gravel. "Come on, Mom," Lenny said, exhausted. "Let's get the professor inside." The man whom her son had called the professor had only enough strength to allow the limited combined efforts of herself and Lenny to guide him into the house and onto the couch. His blood quickly marred the green and white fabric, and Jeanine thought, briefly, how terribly difficult it was going to be to remove those stains. The professor eased onto his back without aid from either of them, blinked a few quick times while studying the ceiling, then closed his eyes. A few driveway pebbles were stuck in his short, matted gray and white beard, and Jeanine brushed them away. "Go to the bedroom and get me a couple of washcloths," she said to Lenny, "and bring me a small pan of cool water." Lenny exited the living room and disappeared into a hallway that led to the bathroom as Jeanine unbuttoned the professor's shirt and peeled it from sticky skin. She rolled the right half of the shirt to fully uncover the bullet wound. Blood still oozed from it, creating a darker pattern in the center that resembled a red star. And she was suddenly back outside, dazed and confused, wanting to caress the smooth wood surface of the box and the station wagon. The red glistening star. The desire. The fear. Uncontrollable. "Here you go," Lenny's voice broke the spell. "Is it bad?" She grabbed both washcloths from her son's hand, dipped one into the plastic mixing bowl that Lenny had filled with water, then folded it lengthwise and draped it across the professor's forehead. She wetted the second washcloth and began mopping up the sticky mess of blood from the skin surrounding the wound. She wrenched the washcloth several times until the bowl of water turned crimson. "He'll live for now, but I'm afraid the bullet is still inside him," she said over her shoulder, not looking at Lenny. "I'm afraid he's going to need a hospital. Don't know what the bullet's done to him inside, but he needs to have it removed." The professor suddenly snapped his eyes open and started to rise, but was gently forced down by Jeanine's hand. "No," he demanded without shouting. "No doctors, no hospitals, no policemen. They'll find me if you do. They'll find the cubit. You can't let that happen." He grasped Jeanine's hand and searched her gray eyes. "You can't let that happen." She immediately connected the word cubit with the wooden box outside. Again, there was that feeling of knowing something, but not remembering just how you knew it. "You'll die without help," Jeanine demanded, and reached forward to flip the wet washcloth on the professor's forehead. "The dagger," he moaned. Use the dagger." Then he closed his eyes and became silent. His breathing came in short spurts. A tiny runner of blood emerged from the right corner of his mouth. Jeanine guessed that he had little life left. "What about this dagger?" she asked Lenny. "You know what he's talking about?" "Yeah, it's out in the car. But I don't understand how it's going to help matters." Jeanine rose from the professor's side and turned to her son. "I mean, he used it to kill a cop." She could have asked him to explain in more detail, and probably would later. Right now she believed that the man on the couch would soon die. She didn't know what the dagger was nor how it could possibly help the situation, but the professor's last words had been, "Use the dagger." "Please get it for me," she said, and reached forward to pull the collar of Lenny's t-shirt away from his neck. "And once we take care of him, I'll dress you up." Lenny's first thoughts were those planted by Stephen King's Children of the Corn. His mother had never allowed him to watch that movie while growing up in a cornfield. Those images were not conducive to a healthy young Kansas mind. And Lenny had found this assumption to be true when he'd finally seen it in his University of Texas dorm room just last week. His roommate had rented it. It had not been Lenny's choice. Now as he stood on the porch, he wondered where he who walks among the corn might be. Had the professor really killed him? Or was the dead state trooper out there still? was he walking among the rows just beyond the porch, waiting for cowardly Lenny Bender. His imagination coalesced into a fear that had him looking in every direction. He stepped from the porch and scampered to the back of the pickup, brushing the bumper with his blue jean thigh hard enough to embed a rust-red streak into the fibers. By the time he reached the passenger side door of the station wagon, he'd freaked himself out so badly that a Sunday morning crow, looking for an early meal, made him squeal when it flew a few feet above his head. He gasped in much the same way as he'd done while watching Children of the Corn. Once inside the station wagon, he slammed the door, breathing hard, trying to regain composure, though the puke-encrusted seat was a gentle reminder of his cowardice. He snapped open the glove box, thinking as he did so that a blue-red spark might shoot from its black depths and abruptly cause Lenny to abandon his effort. Cautiously, he stuck his hand in. The dagger's blade was quite sharp. He was not interested in the pain that it might cause. He was a coward, a paranoid, and a scared little boy who should have never gone hitchhiking. His hand shuffled across a folded piece of paper, a small book, and the haft of the dagger. He grabbed all three items and set them in his lap. The folded paper was a map that charted southwestern highways through Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The professor had highlighted in yellow Interstate 40 as it ran through the top half of these three states. In Arizona, the highlighting continued south from Interstate 40 through Flagstaff and ended in the city of Sedona. The professor had drawn a yellow circle around Sedona, and Lenny guessed that this was his intended destination. The book was about an inch thick and a bit smaller in width and height than a regular sheet of notebook paper. The cover was worn and felt like cloth. There was no title. When he tried to open the book, all of the pages seemed stuck together except for the center spread. Strange symbols were written on one of the two center pages. He closed the book to reveal an image of a dagger embossed in gold on the back cover. A star, much like the one on the cubit, was etched in the dagger's haft. He rubbed his thumb across the star's edges. It felt warm. His attention shifted to the dagger in his lap. It, too, had a star embedded into the haft just above the blade. It, too, felt warm in his left hand. He moved the dagger into his right hand, and a pulse of energy moved up his arm and into his shoulder where the bullet wound still throbbed. A tingling sensation massaged his collarbone. It kind of tickled. He shoved the book and the map into the glove box, closed it, then rubbed his shoulder. The throb decreased. The pain was subsiding. He still could not lift it easily without accompanied pain, but there was no denying that it felt better. When he exited the station wagon and ran to the house, he didn't notice that the red star centered at the top edge of the cubit was glowing, and that lying on the ground behind the station wagon, encircled by the star's red light, was the crow which had frightened him just minutes before. It writhed in the red glow until Lenny entered the house, then became stiff and still, as the red star on the cubit also died. Janine finished cleaning the blood from the professor's chest and moved his legs and arms into a comfortable position on the couch. The bullet hole still oozed, and she quickly mopped stray dribbles with the washcloth. "This thing just might do the trick," Lenny said in the doorway. "It has some..." Lenny struggled for the right word. "It has some kind of electricity in it. It helped my shoulder." "What are you talking about?" Janine rose from the professor's side and studied the dagger in her son's hand. "I don't know. I felt a kind of an electric tingle that went all the way up to my shoulder. Look, my arm moves a lot better now." Lenny raised and lowered it twice. "It is still painful, but at least it moves." Janine pulled back the collar of his T-shirt. Had she blinked, she would have missed it. And even after some of the flesh at the edge of Lenny's wound seemed to magically stitch itself back together, Janine could not believe it. She rubbed her eyes. "Let me see that," she asked, stepping back. When Lenny gave the dagger to her, she studied the haft's smooth, white surface. The top and bottom of the haft were fatter than the middle and were capped in gold. It was chiseled in such a way that it had five sides. A star embellished one of the sides just above the blade, which curved 7 inches in length to its very thin point. Glistening in the living room's lamplight, it revealed no imperfections. Janine cupped the dagger in her hand, but felt none of what Lenny had described as electricity. She waved it through the air a few times, first overhand, then underhand, not knowing why she did so. "Mom?" Lenny pointed at the professor, whose face had become pale. "Give it to him." She placed the dagger in the professor's unconscious right hand, but she could not get his fingers to wrap around the haft. The red jewel in the star started to glow. She snatched it back and felt its warmth and electricity. "Do you hear that?" she asked Lenny.
"What?"
"That noise. That hum."
"No," Lenny said. "No hum."
But Janine heard it.
"Hmm."
The dagger's glow began to pulse with the sound.
"Hmm."
And then Janine, for reasons she would never understand, moved over the professor's chest and positioned the point of the dagger above the bullet wound. How shoving a sharp object into this man's flesh was going to save him, she didn't know. But it seemed to make sense. Slowly she inserted the blade a quarter of an inch into the bloody wound. Lenny gasped and rushed forward, but was propelled backward by his mother's left arm. "Not now, Lenny," she urged. "But you're..."
"Shh!"
She turned to her son. "Do you want me to kill this man?" She didn't wait for an answer. "Then be quiet!" A full inch of the blade disappeared into the professor's chest. The further the blade went, the brighter the star jewel glowed. Janine wondered how close the blade was to the man's lung. She wondered if she was cutting away vital arteries or veins. She was schooled in first aid, but not surgery. Down the blade went through flesh that presented only minor resistance. The red jewel grew brighter. And then the dagger met an obstacle that Janine was afraid to push through. The blade was in at least 4 inches and filled the bullet wound at the skin's surface completely. She believed she had struck bone, since only the slightest nudge of the dagger met with staunch resistance. The jewel blazed red. Her arm trembled. The professor stirred, said something unintelligible, a mumble with no meaning. Janine began to draw the dagger out of the wound, but as she did so, she felt a gentle tug, as if the man's body did not want the blade to be removed. She lifted with force. 1 inch emerged. 2 inches. Like a medieval sword from a fleshy stone. 3 inches. 4. Both Janine and Lenny gasped simultaneously. Clinging as if magnetized to the point of the dagger was a half-inch misshapen piece of metal. The bullet was coated in blood and was blunted from its impact with the professor's body. With the blade and bullet out of the professor, the jewel in the dagger's haft faded, and the bullet dropped onto the professor's shoulder, where it rolled, creating a narrow trail of blood toward the center of his chest. Janine snatched the bullet, rolled it between thumb and index finger, then dropped it into the plastic bowl of red water. She wiped the professor's chest, rinsed the washcloth several times, then wrapped the blade of the dagger within the washcloth. "I don't know, Lenny," she said, expecting questions. "I just don't know. It is a miracle. In the name of Moses, it is a miracle." She turned to face him. "I'm going to guess that your friend here will recover, but he's going to need some rest. He's lost a lot of blood, and I don't think even this has the power to replenish it." After dumping bloody water into the bathroom sink and placing the bullet next to the sink's faucet, Janine retrieved a blanket from the hall closet and draped it over the professor. The color was returning to his face, and this satisfied her belief that he would recover. She took her son by the hand, placed the dagger in the pocket of her housecoat, and headed for her special room, the one she kept under the house. Janine and Michael had agreed on the internal basement shelter the day after a Category 3 tornado had destroyed the north end of Pickett's Crossing. It had missed their farm by just a few miles. Had the tornado taken a different track, one to the south of town, much of their crops and perhaps even their home would have disappeared into the late June summer afternoon. The only discussion they'd had was not if they needed a shelter, but where it would be located. Most storm shelters were external, but Janine had seen in an issue of Family Circle how internal storm shelters were economical, safe, and could double as an added room when not being used to protect the family from imminent harm. If the Benders were to decide on an internal shelter, they would have to build an addition onto the house. The cost with the addition would be nearly double that of an external shelter. And this is where their discussion, which was never an argument but a discussion, had heated by the smallest degree. Janine and her husband never fought, but the added investment, which would essentially add 2 rooms to their house, was one of those rare moments when discussion neared the intensity of an argument. Could they afford it with a 10-year-old child whose complex move into adolescence was just around the corner? Certainly the weather could never be predicted. Tornadoes aside, drought could hit and decimate their crops. Or perhaps their crops would become infested by some of the diseases or insects that Michael had read about in Agricultural Digest. They needed the extra $10,000 as an investment that would always be available for such just-in-case circumstances. Janine had always wanted an addition. The house seemed just a bit too small, especially with Lenny requiring more and more privacy as he grew older. She had discussed the prospect with Michael on several occasions, and Michael had always told her, as he did when the idea of a storm shelter arose, that they needed to be frugal, watch their expenses. Disaster could strike any time, and they had to be ready for it. But the Bender farm had been prosperous for 5 straight years. Their newest venture, that of raising AKC-registered black Labradors, was starting to show a profit. It was time to stop thinking about all the bad that could happen and do something for themselves. This is where Janine's side of the discussion had won out. They had waited so long for something bad to happen that they were not enjoying the good while they could. Had Janine known that within the next 10 years her husband would be dead and much of the Bender assets would be sold, she would have put the money that an external shelter would have saved them into an account that, today, would be of great use. Some amount of savings would have helped her run from this collection of bad memories and move someplace special, a place she often thought of as paradise. A place with sandy beaches and ocean waves where small-town friendly people knew you by name. A place far from here that was, just like in The Wizard of Oz, somewhere over the rainbow. Janine gazed at the snapshot photo of a scene from The Wizard of Oz. The professor and Lenny were both fast asleep upstairs. It was just a little before dawn, and she could not get back to sleep. Her mind was preoccupied with the picture. Dorothy was leaning against Auntie Em's wooden wagon wheel, singing about rainbows, pretty little bluebirds, and why, oh, why can't I? Janine sympathized with Dorothy. Why, oh, why couldn't they? Dorothy was stuck in a world of grown-ups and rules. Janine was stuck in a world of alcoholic control. And just like in The Wizard of Oz, along came a professor to offer them both the hope of miracles. She didn't know what the professor's name was upstairs, but doubted very seriously if it was anything close to Marvell. The man upstairs, however, had something even the wizard did not, a magic dagger. One that could draw bullets from bodies. One that by its simplest touch could heal and certainly kill. The professor's dagger was as marvelous as anything in the world of Oz, and perhaps, just perhaps, it could help Janine fly from here, just like pretty little bluebirds, to her own Oz, to her own paradise. The storm shelter, which doubled as Janine's private room, was adorned with several pictures in frames that depicted images of what she believed to be paradise. Along with the movie scene from The Wizard of Oz, there were pictures of sunny, warm places, each showing sandy beaches and crashing tidewaters. One was a shot from a beach just outside of Cancun, Mexico. Another depicted a shoreline along the African Mediterranean coast. A third was a beach along the southern end of Australia. All totaled, there were nearly a dozen framed Janine paradises, all of which she knew were unattainable beyond a miracle. On the other walls of her room hung an array of biblical renderings, artifacts, and icons. Most referenced Moses and the Exodus from Egypt. There was a swatch of Hebrew cloth, stone recreations of the Ten Commandments, a picture of Moses standing before the split Red Sea, the words, "Let my people go," scribbled on a tapestry that covered no window, an autographed picture of Charlton Heston, and many dime store novelty items that had some part of the scripture from Exodus inscribed on them. Against the wall adjoining the Paradise Picture Collage and opposite the narrow set of steps that led up to the storm shelter's floor-framed door was a 3-drawer wooden dresser that she had refinished back when things were good. Atop the dresser was a tall mirror framed in the same dark-stained oak as the dresser. Against the wall adjoining the Paradise Picture Collage and opposite the narrow set of steps that led up to the storm shelter's floor-framed door was a 3-drawer wooden dresser that she had refinished back when things were good. Atop the dresser was a tall mirror framed in the same dark-stained oak as the dresser, a small lamp with a shade that was printed with a repeating pattern of angels, and 3 framed pictures,
one of Michael, one of Lenny, and one of the three of them together with their prize-winning and most beloved Labrador, Betty. Janine rose from her bed, a double-sized mattress that took up two-thirds of the space in the room, and stepped to the dresser. She grabbed the picture of her family, ran a finger across the outline of her husband, tickled the chin of Betty, rubbed the shoulder of her son. The Janine in the picture was not the Janine she now stared at in the mirror. Though it had been only 5 years since the picture had been taken, the changes in her face were three times in age. She would be 42 in 3 months, but the lines under her eyes, the crinkled forehead, and a full head of gray hair made her look much, much older. Physically and mentally, she was 42, but her appearance was frail. Her aged look was one of the reasons why she had become reclusive. Albert was the other. She gazed over at the miracle dagger lying on the mattress at the foot of the bed and thought about Albert, about escape, about paradise. It could be used to cure, but could it also be used to kill? Better yet, would it recognize Albert for the scumbag alcoholic he was and somehow fling itself into the demon's heart? She could not do it herself. She was a Christian lady. "Thou shalt not kill," the picture of Moses seemed to say to her. But was wishing for death the same as committing the act? Was it right to free oneself by killing others? Moses had, hadn't he? He'd slain an Egyptian slave master who was beating a frail Hebrew worker. He'd killed all the Egyptian firstborn. He'd directed Pharaoh's army into the Red Sea and drowned them, not to mention all the people his Israelite army massacred on the way to the Promised Land. In his exodus, Moses had killed many. So it was right, then, to kill for freedom. With her Bible as rationale, she would not rot in hell. Instead, she would be free to find heaven. Still, she could not, by her own hand, thrust the dagger into any person, even if Albert was asleep, which was the only time she felt that it might be possible to kill him. She could not. Even if she found out that it had been Albert who had killed her husband, she could not. Even if Albert threatened her once again, with wife-beating ramifications to her threats of leaving him, she could not. She stared into the mirror, searching her own slate-gray eyes for an answer. She looked at her hands, already spotted and wrinkled well beyond her age. Were these the hands of a killer? Were these the eyes that could forever withhold the truth about the murderer she would become? Further, how many times has she stood in this exact spot, gazing at her reflection and wondering, what if? She'd never done it. She never could do it. But then there was the dagger. And again there was that feeling of knowing without knowing how you knew. The dagger was the key to her salvation. She stepped to the edge of the bed, grabbed the weapon, unwrapped the washcloth. She moved the haft from hand to hand, caressing its smooth surface, thumbing its fine craftsmanship, gazing at the golden star that was jeweled in red and only one of the 5 points. A knock on the storm shelter's door above her broke her from her trance. "Yes," she said. "Mom?" Lenny's voice was a whisper above the heavy wooden door. "I can't sleep. You mind if I come down?" Janine wrapped the washcloth around the blade of the dagger and set it on her dresser. She, again, stared into her gray, sad eyes, searching. Perhaps Lenny could tell her more about this dagger, about the red stars. Perhaps, with his help, she would be able to do it. "Okay," she said. "Come down." The first thing Janine did when her son reached the foot of the steps was pull him close to her. With a gentle hug, she asked him about his shoulder. Lenny had changed shirts into one which pictured Gravedigger, the monster truck he'd raved over through his teen years. This jerked a tear from the corner of her eye. It was the same T-shirt he was wearing in the family picture on the dresser. "My shoulder is still sore, but I'll live," Lenny said. Janine pulled the collar of his shirt forward to reveal red inflammation underneath a large Band-Aid. She peeled back the Band-Aid, was satisfied that the bullet wound was not infected, and replaced it. "How's your friend?" she said. "Well, I wouldn't exactly call him my friend." Lenny stepped back from his mother's embrace. "He's still sleeping. He was mumbling something before I came down. Probably just dreaming, I guess." "Come over and sit down. We haven't talked in a good while. You don't write much or call." Janine stopped short of sounding confrontational as she and Lenny sat at the foot of the bed. "Anyway, it's really good to see you." "I dropped out of school." Lenny stared at his socked feet.
Janine was not surprised, but she felt his withholding of information up until now added another degree of detachment between them.
"Agricultural science just isn't my thing," he continued. "Besides, without Dad..."
He looked up and into his mother's eyes.
"I mean, it was him who wanted me to follow in his footsteps, to take over the farm some day."
Though he tried, Lenny could not fight back the welling tears.
"I know." Janine caressed her son's hand between both of hers. She was upset with her son's decision to leave college, but knew that he was right. After all, there was not much left of the farm for him to follow in the footsteps of the man who had built it. "If it is the will of the Lord, then so be it. How long has it been?"
"Dropped out before the beginning of last spring semester. It was hard to study and work and stay interested in agriculture all at the same time."
"What are you doing now?"
Janine remained supportive.
"Doing now?"
Lenny looked confused, tired.
"In San Antonio. You working?"
Lenny hunched forward and stared at his feet as if trying to think of something to say. Janine was beginning to feel that a change of subject was necessary.
I was just laid off from this construction company."
His feet dangled an inch off the floor, and he shuffled them back and forth as he spoke.
"They were good people, but the work just dried up."
"What happened tonight?" Janine said, squeezing and pulling his hand as if to nudge him into looking at her. He turned. A slight tremble emerged in the corner of his mouth.
"I had a really horrible dream," he said.
"No, I mean with the professor and all."
"That's what I mean. Before I came down here, I was dreaming about it. At least parts of it, the really bad parts. Stuff that didn't even happen. At least I don't think it happened. I mean, oh hell, I don't know what I mean."
He looked up at the walls where Moses' picture stared down at him.
"Sorry, I didn't mean to say hell."
Janine pulled him as close to her as his body language would allow.
"Tell me, what did you dream?"
Lenny's eyebrows curled inward helplessly. His lip trembled more briskly as he said,
"I have to kill myself."
Inwardly, Janine gasped, but she didn't want to show such shocking emotion in her son's time of need.
"You know this from your dream?" she said.
"From the professor."
"The professor told you to kill yourself?"
"Yeah, I know. Why would he do that?
Hell..."
He looked up at Moses and the split water walls of the Red Sea behind him.
"Heck, we saved his life. He saved my life. That thing was dead, but it was alive. He killed it after that dead thing shot us, and the cubit... I didn't touch it, I swear. But he said I did, and now I have to kill myself. I have to kill myself with that dagger."
"Whoa, hold on." Janine double-clutched his hand. "Let's take this one step at a time." Lenny's eyes suddenly boiled with intensity, fear, and shock. He stared straight through her.
"I saw me, Mom. I saw me in my dream. And I was dead. I looked just like me, but I wasn't me. I was a dead Lenny trying to kill me. An anti-Lenny. An evil Lenny."
He clutched his mother's elbow with his right arm, while his left hand remained clasped within hers.
"That was the dream part. The dead trooper was real. But they are connected. They are both a part of that cubit. Whatever you do, don't touch it."
He squeezed her arm tight enough to constrict the blood flow.
"Stay as far away as you can. It's evil, Mom. It wants to destroy the world."
Lenny collapsed onto his mother's lap. She caressed his temple and forehead as his eyes fluttered in a fight between consciousness and sleep. The revelations he'd unleashed in the past couple of minutes were too much for her to even try and comprehend. All she knew was that her son needed her. Something traumatic had taken his mind and had ripped it apart, and now his dreams were keeping him awake. And they had to be dreams. Dead people didn't shoot guns. She eased Lenny onto the bed and snuck a pillow under his head. He'd finally fallen asleep. She stretched out beside him and draped one arm across his chest, felt his racing heartbeat that seemed to skip a beat or two. Her own eyes blinked with exhaustion, her mind raced with scattered pieces of information. Dead people. Lenny committing suicide. A magic dagger. Paradise. The cubit. Lying beside her son, Janine fell asleep thinking about the small wooden box in the back of the professor's station wagon, the red star on its top edge, and how it had drawn her to it, how it had wanted her to touch it.